Thank you very much, David, for that very kind introduction. At least some of it was true, and I very much appreciate it and very pleased to be here to be able to talk with you. What I want to be able to talk to you about tonight is this whole question, which David described as one of the most ancient in the questions that have bothered and troubled and intrigued people going back really 2,000 years, more than that, that we've addressed both with philosophy, mythology, religion, and now with science, which is the search for planets beyond our own solar system and the search for life beyond our solar system. And I'll try to convince you that we really live in a wonderful era where we now actually can bring the tools of science to bear on this. What I'll do is take you through a little bit of a tour of the development of this whole concept is something that we want to be doing, and then step you through our current state of knowledge on the existence of planets beyond the solar system, and then finally how, using the tools that we're in the process of developing, how we can put together a scientific mission to actually reach that goal, perhaps within a decade. So the search is for habitable planets. And it actually does go back a long way. You start with the Greek philosophers. Epicurus said that there are infinite worlds, both like and unlike this world of ours. We must believe in all worlds there are living creatures and plants and other things we see in this world. So it goes back a long time, but this is really a philosophical statement. If we move from the Greek philosophers up to medieval scholars, we have an otherwise sensible astronomer, Galileo, regarding as false and damnable the view of those who had put inhabitants on Jupiter, Venus, Saturn, the Moon, meaning by inhabitants animals like ours and men in particular. So he may not have gotten everything right. He's writing a lot of things. We'll see how this plays out. So you have medieval scholars like Galileo. On the other hand, you have Giordano Bruno, who had what's really a remarkable, in its modernity, statement that there are countless suns and countless Earths all rotating around their suns in exactly the same way as the seven planets in our system. We see only the suns because they are the largest bodies and are luminous, but their planets remained invisible to us because they are smaller and non-luminous. The countless worlds in the universe are no worse and no less inhabited than our Earth. That is a 20th century, 21st century statement of the problem, and you know that's 1580, and I hope that the reception I get at the end of my talk is better than the reception that Giordano Bruno had when he was burned at the stake. So we move from the Greek philosophers to the medieval scholars and martyrs and move to the most intelligent minds of our own era, Hollywood producers, and we have, sort of the, I'll say the 1950s view of the problem. Is there life in outer space? Yes, of course there is, and in fact it is peaceful life, and they come from outer space to tell us that our choice is simple. Join us and live in peace, or pursue your present course and face obliteration. We shall be waiting for your answer. The decision rests with you. So we run the whole gamut from popular culture, philosophy, religion, and I think the exciting thing that I'm trying to convey this evening is that we really do have the opportunity now to investigate this with science. And this is really the focus, this search is the focus of one of NASA's main programs in science, and that is what we call the Origins Program. And it has two major defining questions. One is, where do we come from? And that addresses where the galaxies come from, the first stars, the heavy elements, planetary systems, and even life on the early Earth. What are our origins looking back in time? We address this with large telescopes such as Hubble or future telescopes such as the James Webb Telescope, looking for the first galaxies, the formation of the first elements. And that is one theme that I'll touch on a little bit, although I'll leave most of the cosmology to some of the other very capable speakers who I'm sure you will have in the future or have had in the past. And then the second big question is really, are we alone? Is there life somewhere else? that we can actually identify through astronomical searches. And those two questions have led to this large program within NASA that particularly in the last couple of months has taken on a great deal of visibility in the overall NASA program, and I'll describe that in a couple of minutes. So this leads to some science goals. How do we understand where the first galaxies and the heavy metals formed? Where did they come from? How do stars and planetary systems form and evolve? You know, the planets that we stand on, the sun from which we draw our own energy. And third, can we determine whether habitable or life-bearing planets exist around the nearby stars? And as taken as a whole, this is really the thrust of a large part of NASA's science program in the coming decade. So I want to give you a couple of things that if you walk away with these, you'll know a lot about how to look for planets, how to look for life, why we think that's possible. So the first thing to realize is the necessary ingredients of life, certainly as we understand it, are widespread throughout the galaxy, throughout the universe. First, it's a remarkable fact that a relatively small number of physical and chemical laws apply in our laboratory, on another planet, in our own galaxy, on other stars, to the most distant galaxies we see. We have a good understanding of the basic building blocks of physics and chemistry. We understand the origin of the elements and their dispersal throughout the solar system, the galaxy, other galaxies throughout the universe, and the properties of an element of hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, or oxygen in a laboratory here is going to be the same as those atoms seen in the most distant quasar. Something that will come up again in a minute is one of those elements, carbon, really stands out as unique from the other elements. The carbon bond does things that other elements don't do. Science fiction talks a lot about silicon life. Don't worry about it. Carbon is going to be it. I mean, maybe our laptops will be the next form of life. That's possible. But spontaneous creation of silicon life, as I'll try and convince you in a little while, is unlikely. Carbon is going to be where it's at. Life on Earth, originally thought to be something that really only survived in a very small variation of temperature, pressure, and so on. In the last 25 years or so, environmental biologists, microbiologists have found that life is remarkably hardy and can exist in extremes of temperature, chemistry, humidity, pressure, and so on. So that was a realization that I think helps expand our view of how life might evolve and thrive in places that are quite different from our own. We can see that life can affect the planetary environment in a large and detectable way, and our own atmosphere clearly reflects the presence of primitive life and sometimes advanced life, maybe intelligent life, maybe not so intelligent life. So we're certainly able to find life potentially by sensing its atmosphere and inferring the presence of not purely chemical or geological processes. Another thing that's quite a new understanding over the last 25 to 50 years is an understanding that planets themselves are a common outcome of the processes that lead to the formation of stars. And the modern theory of star formation makes the formation of planets likely as well. It wasn't always that way. Back in the turn of the 20th century, the leading astronomers such as Eddington had the view that planets were the result of a grazing collision between two stars that would pull off some material and make little droplets that would condense and create planets, intrinsically a very rare phenomenon. We now understand, and I'll describe a little bit later, the fact that our theory, which is now well borne out by observation, shows that stars form in a very different way that make planets themselves quite likely. So if you take these different thoughts, that the ingredients of life are widespread, the chemical laws that control the chemical reactions, we're starting to understand them, that life can form and thrive in quite different environments than our own, that life can affect the planetary environment in a way that we could detect, and that planets are common, those are really the themes that come together along with our technology and suggest that we may be able to find life with some reasonable probability beyond our own solar system. So I'll step through some of these and with a bit more detail and then try and show you how we'll actually put all this together to come up with some missions and some facilities to do some of this. So just organic chemistry, carbon-based chemistry, linkages between carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and so on, is very common throughout space beyond just the Earth. In comets, in interstellar dust clouds, we've seen spectra that give us the fingerprints of over 100 gas phase molecules, ices, minerals, and so on, water, CO2, formic acid, very long chain molecules, lots of carbon-bearing, CH-bearing species, very rare to find sulfur or silicon compounds, one or two, not very many. The list of over 100 organic chemicals, it reads like a chemistry lab ordering guide. Just very quickly, you see in comets we have different ones of these species, in interstellar clouds we have perhaps different ratios, but you find all these complicated things distributed nearby us in comets, nearby clouds of gas and dust. You go to distant galaxies, this is a particular Hubble picture of one, and you wind up seeing complicated large carbon molecules, either rings or flat planes, long chains. We see these in many galaxies. We see something like carbon monoxide, which is a gas associated with, in nearby objects, quite complicated organic species at the most distant quasars that we can see. So all throughout the solar system, the galaxy, and the most distant galaxies, we find the basic organic building blocks of life. Not life itself, but certainly the chemistry that is the root of life as we know it. The other thing to recognize is that life has been found to be very hardy. This is a hot lake up in Yellowstone, very difficult conditions for life to exist in, yet we find that things that bugs called extremophiles can live in hot, highly acidic lakes near undersea volcanic vents up off the coast of Washington and underground aquifers a few kilometers down in the Columbia River Basin and even within rocks down in Antarctica. This is a close-up of a cross-section of a rock. You can see the top surface here. A few millimeters down is a layer of lichen. Water trickles in through the cracks in the rock. Light is refracted in through the crystals, and this little band of lichen here has found a way to make a living. It can happen almost anywhere on the Earth. There are very few places that are completely without some form of biology on our planet. And that's really led many of the biologists to aver, not yet with proof, but that what life really needs is a source of water, some source of free energy. It could be photosynthetic energy, it could be sunlight, but it could be chemical energy. Life could form deep down in these aquifers where there is no sunshine. It could just be heat, as in these volcanic vents, and as we've seen, the cosmically abundant elements. Water is certainly a key part of this, and certainly those of you who have been listening to the news the last couple of days and managed to listen through the noise and the chatter of Super Tuesday would have noted that NASA had a press conference on the worst possible news day to announce something really quite remarkable, which of course is water on Mars. I mean, the fact that we found with the rovers evidence for past water on the surface of Mars, really finding liquid water, is really, I think, in fact, very exciting. So the top is the view of the Opportunity landing site. This is one of the rocks that they've been looking at, El Capitan. This is a close-up. And one thing you'll notice here is this rippling effect here is evidence by itself for standing water. Might have been wind, but the feeling among the geologists is that is some evidence for there being water having been there. If you take a close-up using the microscopic camera on Opportunity, you see this crusted material here, these little spherules. These are what tend to grow up as water is evaporating from a salty brine. if you look now with the alpha X-ray spectrometer, you see evidence for different sorts of salts, sulfur, chlorine, bromine, that are characteristic of an evaporite from a brine. And then you come over to here, you look at the Mossbauer spectrum of this rock El Capitan, and you find a number of different minerals, one of which is this thing here called jarosite. I won't pretend to know what it is. There may be some mineralogists here who do, but it is one of the precursors of the hematite that Opportunity was landed in an area to be rich in hematite. And there are a number of different ways to create hematite. There's a volcanic processes or a number of others. There's weathering processes that can lead to hematite. But the one that leads through water and water processing has as a precursor this mineral jarosite. And this is what they found in the Mossbauer spectrum. So they put together, you know, just the simple appearance of the rock and the silt on the surface. You look closely in a microphotograph at the data that looks like an evaporite deposition here. These spherules grow and as material is being evaporated. You look here in the composition of the material. You see the evidence of these salts typically found in brines. And then you look at the mineralogy and you see an aqueous precursor to hematite. And you have evidence then for bodies of standing water or certainly flowing liquid water on the surface of Mars. So it's a very exciting aspect of looking for at least the conditions where life might have formed within our own solar system. And Mars is clearly probably the best alternative site to our own Earth. So I won't spend a lot more time on the Mars discovery. Certainly it's not my particular area of research, but since it was so much in the news, I wanted to give you a sense of where this fits in. What we're going to do now is sort of go back and say, how can we look for life if we don't have the opportunity to land there? The first thing I'll show is, you know, everyone always asks, does NASA, you know, where does NASA really do this stuff? What do the images really look like? And what are the images we don't show you? Well, I can't show you this one much longer. So we get now to the remote sensing question. How can we know that life actually affects its atmosphere and the atmosphere of the planet that it's on? And one way we do that is we look back in time through the geological record, and we can basically look back and see that going back a few billion years, or say within the first billion or billion and a half years on the surface of the Earth, there's very little oxygen present, looking at oxidation products in the rocks and so on. You don't see much. And then there's some steps associated with the first, you know, single-celled creatures, and you start developing first photosynthesis, and you move up in time, and the oxygen abundance on the surface of the planet increases by many orders of magnitude till we get up into this period here, when in fact oxygen is a significant part of our own atmosphere. And this oxygen here is really attributable to the effects of photosynthesis. Without photosynthesis, if you stop producing oxygen through the action of plant life on the surface of the Earth, the amount of oxygen would very quickly tail away. In a few millions of years, it would all just get caught up on the rocks on the surface, and then through plate tectonics just disappear off the planet altogether. So we really are seeing here, in the case of our own oxygen atmosphere, the effects of life on a planetary scale. If you look in a bit more detail on what the production of various gases would be in a world with life, our own Earth here, or without life, you see very large differences in many of these particular gases. I won't go over this in a lot of detail. Methane is quite abundant due to life on Earth, whereas without Earth, it would be a very small trace feature. You have methane in conjunction with large amounts of oxygen, which is not favored chemically at all. You wouldn't see any free oxygen over here on a world without life. And so on, if you look at all these different species, the first thing you really note is there's a much richer blend of gases in an Earth with life than what you would have without life. And it's really these differences and these deviations from equilibrium chemistry that are a real signpost of life with the details perhaps depending on the exact sort of life you have. What would the Earth look like as seen from afar? This is a spectrum of the Earth's atmosphere as seen from one of the Mars probes looking back towards Earth. So this is just a graph showing what the infrared spectrum, the signatures of the Earth's atmosphere would be at a variety of wavelengths out in the infrared and sort of the heat part of the spectrum. So here's the intensity, here's the wavelength, and here's then the Earth with signatures of water. All these little ups and downs here are reproducible, they're not noise in the data. So here's water, this big dark absorption band here is from carbon dioxide. We have ozone over here, and then water and methane is buried down in here as well. So if you look back at our Earth with a real instrument from as far away as Mars, you would say, gee, ozone comes from the breakdown of oxygen, so there's probably oxygen on this planet. We have water, that's good. CO2, gee, maybe there's a cycle between carbon dioxide, oxygen, ozone, more water here. These are the sort of things that you could put together from a remote sensing standpoint and say that, gee, perhaps there's something going on this planet. And given that we know that these are characteristic of life, if you had the same signature on a more distant planet, you'd be very tempted to say that there was life on this particular body with its particular temperature and so on. So the nascent science of astrobiology really works quite hard to assess what are the right signatures to look for if we were to apply these techniques to planets around other stars. You can also work in another part of the spectrum, not just in the infrared. You could work in visible light and do the same sort of thing. This is an experiment where this is the illuminated part of the Earth's surface as seen from the moon. You look at the moonlight just so you can look at an entire half hemisphere of the Earth in reflected light, and you can sort of see in the visible light, you can see the spectrum here, and you can see quite a complex spectrum. You can break that up into such things as, again, there's ozone, there's water, there's molecular oxygen, there's more water here, and there's some CO2 at a little bit more red wavelength. Over in here, you can see the influence of vegetation. There's a chlorophyll feature down in here. You put all that together, you can start to, even at visible light, infer something about the properties of the planet and the properties of its atmosphere and detect reasonably good signatures for, again, primitive forms of life. And you can see oxygen and water, and you can look for things like chlorophyll. So at a variety of different wavelengths, we have techniques that if we could collect the light from the planet, seen from afar, we could start to infer information about the existence or absence of life itself. So what we're trying to convince you is that we can use the techniques of remote sensing to look for such things as oxygen or its proxy ozone. We can look for water, which is really not so much a signpost of life, but as we've described, is really a essential thing to have if you're going to have a life-bearing planet. Carbon dioxide tells you a lot about the atmosphere. We see it in all three of the terrestrial planets in our solar system. Venus, Earth, and Mars all have CO2, so it's not a signpost of life directly, but it tells you there is an atmosphere there, and it lets you infer something about the temperature structure and the overall physical state of the planet itself. Methane has potentially biological sources, but there's also some non-biological sources as well that make it a bit more ambiguous, although if you see it in combination with something like oxygen, you can make a fairly strong case for the existence of life as opposed to purely geochemical processes. Again, you want to look for an atmosphere where something out of equilibrium is really happening. You can pretty well predict what geology and chemistry can do in the atmosphere of a planet. You add life, something odd is going to happen, and that's really what you're going to look for. So you expect the unexpected. You don't want to look just for only for oxygen or only for CO2. You'd like to have a fairly broad capability so you can find unexpected things, a planet where nitrous oxide or methane or some, you know, sulfur dioxide, which is a trace element on our planet, could be abundant in another one. You surely don't want to focus too much on our own view of what life must be, but at the same time, you look for those things we know are likely to be abundant, and then also be able to do the unexpected. So one of the conclusions that our science team, both in the US and in Europe, with whom we have a lot of collaboration, have really arrived at, is both visible light information and this infrared radiation provide diagnostics of the physical properties of any planets you'd find, have atmospheric signatures that tell you a lot about the atmosphere, and have potential biomarkers, ozone, oxygen, and so on. Let me now pause and give you a bit of an update on why we think planets themselves are likely to be common. And it actually, even though we say it's a modern theory of star formation, it actually goes back to hypotheses first propounded by Immanuel Kant and Laplace, that basically stars form by collapse of a cloud of gas. The cloud is rotating, and it slowly accretes. The gravity becomes stronger. The planet, the star, accretes more material, and you get a flattened disk in which planets then form as well. So this is just a cartoon showing the dark clouds of gas that start this gravitational collapse. And let's say that's sort of when you start your clock ticking. You can see it's sort of a flattened disk. Within 10 or 100,000 years, you get a protostar embedded in this envelope of gas and dust. And this background picture here is a picture taken with an infrared satellite that went up in the early 80s and really found hundreds and thousands of these young protostars embedded in clouds of gas and dust. And it really led a great deal of observational evidence, along with data from other ground-based telescopes, that we have this process of collapse into a protostar. We then start getting the gas, the placental cloud of gas around the star starts to be blown away. The star itself starts to emerge, perhaps after 100,000 or a million years. In this time period as well, planets are starting to be formed in this remnant disk. In this period of a few 100,000 to a few million years, most of the material out of which the star is formed has blown away, and you actually are now seeing a pretty well-developed star. And then maybe after 10 to 100 million years, you have a pretty normal star with a planetary system and perhaps some remnant material, the dust associated with the construction site. And we have pretty good evidence for all these different stages of the formation of a star and of the planetary systems. So we're developing a fairly good degree of confidence in what started out as quite an old theory, but we've now applied much more mathematical and observational rigor to it. So we see, for example, in these Hubble images, a little disk of material that's illuminated from down below by a very hot star that's formed over here. But you can see in silhouette this disk, which is about the size of a solar system, in fact, a few hundred Sun-Earth distances, what we call an astronomical unit in size. And you can see this disk is being heated, in fact, evaporated away. You look at this image here. This is an image of a bright nearby star. The light from the star has been blocked out by an instrument we call a coronagraph. I'll talk a bit more about that in detail. And what's revealed is this ring of dust that shows up around the star. This is the material that's come down out of the forming material that the star formed out of, and there's now a remnant disk of dust surrounding the star, much like, you know, Saturn's rings. This is a star with a quite well-defined disk of material, and depending on your theoretical model of the moment, some of the structure in this disk can be attributed possibly to the presence of planets themselves. These are some images of some other stars with disks around them. These are three quite bright stars you could see with your naked eye. Fomalhaut, Beta Pictoris, and Epsilon Aries are all bright nearby stars. And these maps, taking at quite long wavelengths, show you quite a lot of structure in the disk. This looks like there's a ring of material, a torus or a donut seen edge on, and you wind up seeing the material at the two ends being quite bright. This is another star. The star is sort of in the center, and there's a bright area of the disk. Perhaps there's a big clump seen edge on. Here's a face-on disk with clumps in it. And there's quite a lot of theoretical activity that says that this clumping could be due to cavities evacuated due to the presence of planets. It's one of a number of different theories. For scale, here's the Sun in the orbit of Pluto. So you have in here, again, solar system-sized objects with solid material in orbit around it, clumpiness suggestive of the presence of planets, not yet direct evidence for planets around these objects, but certainly evidence for solid material out of which planets might have formed. I'll mention one of the NASA satellites has just been launched. It's called the Spitzer Space Telescope. It took about 25 years to go from its first conception into orbit, something that should give pause to anyone who's proposing their own new satellite to do something hard, such as the one I'm talking about. These things do take a long time to get the technology, the funding, the people, everything in the right place. But what we're going to see with the Spitzer telescope is a lot more of this mapping of regions of star formation, looking for planetary disks, and so on. The first part of that image was the optical image, you know, still showed down here, and you can't see through this dark cloud of gas and dust. As you start looking into infrared wavelengths, you can start seeing through this material, and you start seeing, in fact, this little blob of light, you can't really tell what it is in the visible, shows up very clearly as a very young star starting to eject its placental cloud of material. Another image, first in the optical, that'll then fade into the infrared picture. You start seeing into the cloud itself. You start seeing some of the young stars that are forming in this particular nebula. Just another pretty picture. Again, one of these star-forming regions. Many of these little clumps in here are indeed young stars seen in the process of formation. So the Spitzer telescope will spend a lot of time looking at these disks, trying to characterize them in some detail. How do these disks of material form in single and binary stars as a function of the ages of stars? Are there planets, not planets? What are the ages? How do the disks evolve with time? As planets accumulate, does the material go away, go into planets? How does the grain composition change? And we can get down to very sensitive levels of this disk emission relative to our own solar system. One of the images from Spitzer shows an image of the Fomalhaut disk at two different wavelengths, 24 and 70 microns. You're sensitive to sort of room temperature material up here, quite cold material here, and you can start to see that there's quite a lot of hot dust in close to the star and still quite a lot of cold dust out here, a few tens to 100 astronomical units away from the star, where there might be, you know, one or two large gas giant planets out at these large separations. We're just starting to get the very first data from the Spitzer Observatory just in the last couple of months. So there'll be a lot more on this in the coming years. And one of the things we want to do is understand how these clouds of gas and dust relate to the formation and evolution of planetary systems themselves. So we've seen that there is a strong theoretical underpinning for the idea that there should be planets out there. What do we actually know about the existence of planets? As David described, Jeff Marcy has been one of the leaders in the world, the leader in the world, for finding these gas giant planets using the wobble induced by the position or velocity of the star due to the presence of this orbiting planet. And over 115 gas giant planets ranging from Saturn, less than the mass of Saturn, up to and greater than the mass of Jupiter have been found around a comparable number of stars. And this little graphic here just shows that some of these planets are found in close, Some of them are found quite far away from their parent star. This is in astronomical units, and you see a large variety of planetary masses. You see in a couple of cases multiple systems, and perhaps as many as half of the systems for which one has found at least one planet, in fact, there may be multiple planets there. One such system here, 55 Cancri, has Jupiter out at a few astronomical units, a little bit inside the orbit of Jupiter, but still pretty far out. It has two smaller, but still larger than the Earth planets in close, and then this big open region in here. We don't have the sensitivity yet to detect an Earth in this region, but this is starting to resemble an analog of our own solar system. Big gas giant out close, and then a big void in here where you could put an Earth there and it would be in a stable orbit. We have a number of different techniques for looking at this wobble of a star due to the presence of a planet. We can look for the wobble in the position of the star. We have a mission I'll describe in a minute, the Space Interferometer mission that I'm involved with that will actually look for the positional wobble. We have Marcy's technique of looking for the velocity wobbles, and we'll be able to determine the architecture of solar systems. Is our own system unique, different, common? We just don't know the answer to that yet. There's another technique for finding planets called the transit system. It's of late been quite interesting, and it has an honorable history in astronomy. The planetary transit was actually first used to make what I would call a cosmological measurement back in the mid-1700s. It was determined that if you could measure the transit of Venus across the face of the Sun, you'd be able to figure out the distance between the Earth and the Sun, 93 million miles. Everybody knows that. They didn't know it then. It was the equivalent of trying to measure the Hubble constant, the scale of the universe. So one of the reasons for the expedition of Captain Cook into the Pacific was to, in fact, go measure this transit of Venus. So Captain Cook is shown here with his hand out trying to get money from Lord Sandwich, that Sandwich. He has with him another patron, Joseph Banks. They estimated the cost of their expedition at £10,000. They are wrong by a factor of five, quite traditional in astronomy to do that. They didn't include the cost of the vehicle to get them there, also traditional in astronomy, not to count the cost of the shuttle. That got them there. They got to their observatory, they built it, and unlike most astronomy, they actually were able to get the observations through clear weather. So that actually worked out reasonably well, and they're actually able to make at least a first measurement of the scale of the solar system. Turned out to be comparable to other methods, so it was confirming in the way that you get lots of measurements of critical parameters like this. But this has an awful lot of the hallmarks of modern day astronomy. So how does this relate to transits now? Here I have to come over to here. Just to give you an idea of what does a transit do. Let's see if we can make this work. Didn't work, too bad. There's a little movie in there that just showed what happens when a transit planet goes across the face of the star. But you can imagine here, here's a planet going across the face of the Sun. The light from the star actually drops by a few percent. And this was predicted to happen for one of the stars for which Jeff Marcy and his crowd had found evidence for a planet. And if the star and planet were aligned just edge on, as the planet came around in front, as shown here, the light signal would drop and then go back up as the planet goes around the other side. And there's a group of astronomers in Colorado, another group in Tennessee with a little tiny telescope, 10-inch telescope, in their parking lot at their institute, and they took this particular prediction and, lo and behold, got this early result. And it's a remarkable example of why science is different than anything else. Here you have this very complicated observational procedure that Jeff Marcy had used, radial velocities, big telescopes at Keck and at Lick, reducing the data very carefully, getting this tiny wobble, and then a prediction. If this system is edge-on, then the planet should go in front of the star at exactly this time, and you should see a diminution in the brightness of the star by a few percent. By a totally independent technique, you get that prediction being borne out. That's why science is different than anything else that humans have come up with, is you predict things and you validate them in a different way. This is the textbook example in my mind of how this really works. And then not only does it confirm, it allows you to draw new conclusions. Now you know how big this star, the planet is relative to its star by how far the signal goes down. You can get a mass, you can get a radius, you have the density. This planet here is somewhat less dense than Saturn. It would actually float in a teacup if you had the right size teacup. It's less than a gram per cc. And you start to learn about the planet having initially confirmed that it was in fact a planet. So there's many active efforts on ground-based telescopes using 10-centimeter telescopes to 10-meter telescopes. There'll be a number of new space missions that the Canadian Space Agency has, NASA has, the Europeans have, and that'll lead to the discovery probably of a few hundreds, tens to hundreds of Earths, probably a few thousands of Jupiters via this technique. Then you take advantage of the fact that at different wavelengths, this planet is subtly different in size depending on the absorbing properties of the atmosphere. Now you can start to probe the atmosphere of a planet around another star itself. So in this particular cartoon, here's the star, here's the planet, here's the atmosphere of the planet. As the light from the star goes through the atmosphere, a little bit of it gets absorbed. You're observing it out here with Hubble, and they've already seen the spectral signatures of hydrogen, carbon, and oxygen boiling off the star as it goes around in its orbit, and you see it in this transit. So it's all an interlocking set of observations that are starting to tell us a lot about these sorts of planets. These are still gas giant planets. These are big ones, Jupiter, Saturn, and so on. But it's certainly getting us in the right direction, and we're starting to be able to learn about planets in other solar systems. There are other techniques, as I mentioned. There's what we call the position wobble of a star. We use this technique called astrometry that measures that. This is what the position of our sun would be if you were measuring it very accurately from 30 light years away. All these wobbles are due to the effect of Jupiter, Saturn, and these little wiggles in here are from the printer, but they're also roughly the scale, but they're roughly the scale of the little wobbles that you would see from the Earth itself. And so an Earth at this distance, you need to measure accurately down to a millionth of a second of arc. That's a small angle, I won't tell you how small it is, but it's enough to tell you whether the left or the right-hand headlight of a Mars rover was on or off, as seen from Earth. So it's a small angle, but with new techniques we can start to measure that, and that lets us get down to the wobbles of planets as small as a few times the mass of the Earth. And when you combine that with our other techniques, we can get a census of planets down to a very precise level. One of the techniques we use to do this very precise positional measurement is a technique called interferometry. We link together the light beams from two large telescopes, medium-sized telescopes, separated by a large distance. That lets us gain the angular resolving power of a single telescope, not 10 meters in size like an individual Keck telescope, but of two telescopes separated by 85 meters, we can simulate a telescope 85 meters in size without having to build such a thing. So it's a very powerful technique that enables all sorts of different observational programs. It will help us make the census of planets. We can detect directly the light from these hot Jupiters. We can look for dust clouds. We can even make images of some of these stellar disks. This is an example of an image of the European interferometer being built down in Chile. This is obviously the two Keck telescopes, which we're already linking together. And then when you take this into space, you don't have the atmospheric effects to worry about. You can complete this census of planetary systems in a very complete way. There's all sorts of things we don't know. Systems like our own common, what's the distribution of planetary masses, are there planets like the Earth in the habitable zone, the region that's just the right temperature for water, So we'll do a broad survey for planets looking at a few thousand stars. We'll make a very deep search of the closest planets to see if they have Earth-like planets. Again, not direct detections, we're still looking for the wobbles, but a few times the mass of the Earth out at 30 light years or so. And then how do these planets evolve with time, looking at young stars, medium-age stars, and old stars. That then brings us to the question of how do we detect the light from these Earths directly? Not their wobble, not their shadow going, you know, not a transit of a star across the surface, the transit of a planet across the surface of a star. How do we get the light itself directly? And that then is the mission I'll finish up with, what we call the Terrestrial Planet Finder. It has the charming acronym TPF. And the goal here is to use either a large, what we call a coronagraph that blocks out the light from the star at visible wavelengths, or one of these interferometers that blocks out the light in a slightly different way in the infrared. And we'd operate for a 5 or 10 year mission. We have a collaboration with the European Space Agency. They intelligently call their mission DARWIN, which makes a lot of sense. There is no acronym. The name may be familiar to some of you, I hope. And the science would be to search solar type stars like our sun out to about 30 light years, look for Earth-sized planets in what we call the Goldilocks zone, not too cold, not too hot, just right for liquid water. Look for habitable planets, in fact, inhabited planets, where we look for these signatures, oxygen, ozone, carbon dioxide, or water, and then also study all the other planets that might be in such a system, understanding the physical properties of a Jupiter, a Saturn, look for the comets, look for the dust, and so on. Now, there are a couple of things that are hard about looking for terrestrial planets. One of them is the closest stars are actually pretty far away. You have to look 30 or 40 light years away, and maybe not all stars have planets, so you have to look at a fair number of them, and 30 or 40 light years may not seem a lot if you have warp drive, but it's quite far enough if you're trying to find a little Earth next to a bright star. You have to have enough light gathering power to gather the light from such a planet, and that's actually not too bad. You can put up a reasonable sized telescope and detect a planet in just a couple of hours. Where it gets hard comes from this graph here. Again, this is wavelength along the bottom. This is visible light over in here, infrared light over in here, and how bright the planet is here, and how bright the star that's right next to it is. And the ratio of how bright the star is to how bright the planet is in visible light, and this is the sun, this is the Earth, again seen from 30 light years, the ratio is more than 9 orders of magnitude. That's more than 1 billion to 1. You get 1 photon from the Earth, you get 1 billion photons from the sun that illuminates that Earth. If you go out into the infrared, the sun is tailing off a bit, the Earth is glowing from its own radiation, so it's only 1 million to 1 problem out here in the infrared wavelength. So this in some ways makes this a bit more favorable as a detection problem, but it's still tough. I mean, 1 million to 1 is a hard enough thing to do. So we're trying to deal with the fact we have to look pretty far away. Sensitivity, not bad, we can do it, but you have to be able to find this faint object right next to a very bright object, about a tenth of an arc second away. Now, an arc second is about the size of the smallest crater you can see on the moon, so a tenth of that is roughly, you know, 10 times smaller than that. So it's pretty small, and right next to that small thing is a very bright thing. And so the way I describe the problem is you're sitting here in Santa Barbara and you want to find a firefly circling around a searchlight in New York. And you're looking right into the searchlight. And just to make it a bit trickier, it's foggy here in Santa Barbara because we exist in a cloud of our own dust, and it's foggy in New York because there's a cloud and haze of dust over there. And that's really the observational challenge that we have to deal with. But, in fact, we think it is technically feasible. And we've spent quite a lot of time thinking about it. And if invisible light or near-infrared light, a fairly simple coronagraph which blocks out the light of the central star, It's a bit more sophisticated than putting your thumb over it, but not a whole lot more sophisticated. This new telescope that NASA's building as a successor to Hubble, the James Webb Telescope, that could actually detect Jupiter around the very closest stars. This is sort of the remnant of the star after you've put your thumb over it, and you can see here's what a Jupiter might look like around a star that's about 7 or 8 light years away. As you start to make a more refined telescope and coronagraph system where you control the light from the star very, very carefully, if you had a 2-meter telescope, a little bit smaller than Hubble, you could find a few hundreds of Jupiters, but probably no Earths. If you had a 4-meter telescope, maybe twice the size of Hubble, you could do lots of Jupiters and survey the nearest 30 to 50 stars and have the sensitivity, if you've made the telescope sufficiently precisely, to find Earths around those 30 to 50 stars. If you had an 8 to 10 meter class telescope of very high quality, then you could probably survey the closest 150 stars looking for Earths. This one's really a challenge. This one up in here is quite plausible, and that's in fact one of the designs we're pursuing very actively. And the sort of things you'd then learn, as I've described, where were the planets, how bright are they, their size, their reflectivity, low resolution spectrum, you get the composition of the atmosphere, the surface. So you'd learn a lot of very interesting things about planets like this. In the laboratory, this is the sort of stuff you put on an optical bench. You'd have to shrink this down and make it work in space after a launch, which you sort of liken to a truck crash, and no one's there to align it for you anymore. So this is all sort of tricky stuff, but in the lab, we can make a dark area, for example, over here, where there are this would be, without the special optics of the coronagraph in place, this would be blasted with light. Very, very bright light. You see a laser beam here coming out at you. We put in this blocking, line here and a lot of careful optics. And down in here, this area in blue is down by about 100,000 to 1 relative to the input laser light. So were this on a telescope in space, you'd be pretty close to being able to pick out an Earth. You're close to it. You've still got a ways to go. The technology isn't perfected yet. But we're making really excellent technical progress on this part of the problem. As I mentioned, there's another way to do this using the interferometers. You might take 3 or 4 telescopes, bring their light beams together, combine them very carefully, and if you had 3 or 4 mirrors on either a 30-meter boom or maybe on individual separated spacecraft to get the maximum sample size, you'd be able to do a detection of a planet in just a few hours. You'd know it was there. You'd see if it had an atmosphere in a few days, higher resolving power, higher signal noise, and you'd actually be able to detect these ozone and methane lines in perhaps 2 weeks of steady observing. But you'd do this on a planet you knew was there and was already interesting on the basis of these preceding observations. So an infrared system is also a plausible one. We're going back and forth on which has the least set of disadvantages relative to the other. None of these systems have advantages, take it from me. They just have fewer disadvantages. How's the interferometer work? I won't spend much time on this. You bring light beams in through this telescope and this telescope. You bring them together. A little magic happens. You put the star on this null point here. The planet's here going in and out of this area where you're letting light in and not in, and you get this little signal, and you say, aha, here's a PhD thesis, and that little signal there is telling you that there's this planet going in and out of these fringes that your telescope has made for you, and from that you can infer the presence of the planet, its temperature, do this at different wavelengths, you can infer the composition of the planet itself. And again, in the laboratory, we're succeeding in doing this pretty well. We need, of order 100,000 to 1. We're up at 10,000 to 1. So we're starting to get there. Here's the nuller is off, this apparatus here. You turn it on, the signal drops by a factor of 10,000. You flip the switch, null goes off again. And you see we have these nice stable nulls on a laboratory light source. You try and do this on the sky. Some of our colleagues at the University of Arizona, here's a normal star. you turn on the nuller, the star really just vanishes. And this is a sort of a normal calibration star. You do this on a star with a dust ring around it, the star goes away and all you see is the little ring with the star itself removed. So we're starting to be able to do what astronomers are not very good at, which is getting rid of starlight. We spent 300 years trying to get starlight. This is now we're trying to get rid of it so we can see the faint planets nearby. And so the technology is progressing pretty well. What is the political will to do something like this? This has been bubbling up from the science community for the last decade, that this was a good thing for scientists to do. And the search for life, the search for habitable planets, is in fact something you can convey to budgeteers and staffers and even, it turns out, presidents, and they say, yeah, that's a good thing to do. The search for life passes what I call the airline test. You're sitting next to your passenger, the passenger next to you, and they say, well, what are you doing? And you say, oh, I'm looking for life on other planets. That's the high concept. They get it right away. String theory is tough. Black holes are tough. I'm looking for life on other planets is something that 220 people in this room are interested in. And it turns out the President of the United States is interested in it. You know, and even one who's not necessarily known for his interest in science is interested in it. It has a very broad appeal, and so there's this new vision post the Columbia tragedy for NASA, and it explicitly addresses this search for planets. I mean, there's a lot of talk about manned missions to Mars, the Moon, robotic exploration, but very explicitly, of the list of 20 things the President has told NASA to do in the next, you know, couple of decades, is conduct advanced telescope searches for Earth-like planets and habitable environments around other stars. That sounds an awful lot like Epicurus or Giordano Bruno. You know, this is the program. If you look in the budget for this year, I won't go into this in any of the awful detail that Microsoft Project people will know and understand. I hope you're not among them. NASA, basically, and the President has laid out for NASA four goals. Do stuff at the moon, robotics, and then land some people there. Do a lot more robotic stuff on Mars. Where are the sites to go to? What are the interesting places? Look for water. Look for fossil life. All these little things here are real robotic missions that are on the books. The red things are sort of the things regarding people, and they are the science fiction part of this. They could slip, come and go with regard to the politics of the day. But I think most of these things that are in yellow are real programs that are, you know, will be conducted. And you go to the outer moons of the planets, Jupiter, Europa, Titan, and so on. Very interesting science there. But here, the fourth leg of this particular stool of NASA science for the next 10 to 20 years is not just general astrophysics, search for extrasolar planets. So Hubble has its role to play. The Kepler mission does this transit search. The Webb telescope will do a lot of, in fact, interesting cosmology and other activities. But it will, as I mentioned, have a role to play in this planet searching. We have the Spitzer infrared telescope that will certainly do these disks of material that are perhaps precursors to or signposts of planets. We have the Space Interferometer mission that does the wobble technique. And then we have the Terrestrial Planet Finder. So this is a real focus of the NASA program, you know, for the next 10 to 20 years. And this is the sort of thing that really does survive the politics of the day in Washington. There'll be big arguments about this stuff up here, the man part of the program. It's expensive and controversial. But I think there's sort of a meeting of the bottom-up interest of the scientific community. If you look around the ITP during the daytimes during this semester's workshop, there are lots of young, excited astronomers and physicists interested in this problem. And I mean, most of you who at all have a science or an engineering background know that the way to find out if something is interesting is look where the graduate students are. If the graduate students are in your field, you're in the right place. And there's a lot of excitement in this whole area of planet finding. It's new and very, very compelling. International collaboration is an important part of doing these things. And in fact, I think they're very much the same cultural and scientific imperatives in Europe as in this side of the pond. We have a very strong ongoing collaboration with the European Space Agency, and we're really looking for a joint project that might launch somewhere around, you know, call it 2015. So there's a whole suite of scientific studies that will happen before then. This is sort of the wobble technique of Jeff Marcy. Here's the transits. Here's the chronograph looking for planets with Webb, astrometry, microlensing I didn't get into, looking at the composition of planets and disks. All these sort of things are the precursor activities that we'll do in the coming years, building up to the terrestrial planet finder itself. And I think it's important to realize that this planet finding is really, we're at the beginning of a decades-long venture. If you think about the way that cosmology started off, you had the 100-inch telescope up at Mount Wilson, with which we discovered just the first expansion of the universe, leading to Hubble, leading to the Webb telescope, which may look back and find the first galaxies in the process of formation. But this is nearly 100 years of effort, development of technology, and so on. And there's interesting science and lots of PhD theses all the way along the way. And in my view, planet finding is at that same starting point, just down here. We're making the first discoveries of the gas giant planets, and we'll be progressing through Kepler, SIM, TPF, son of TPF, as we really try and understand what are the origins of life, is there life outside our solar system, and it really is related to the sense to understand both what's out there and use that to understand better ourselves. And it brings to mind this line from T.S. Eliot that we shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all of our exploring will be to arrive where we started and to know the place for the first time. Through the unknown remembered gate, when the last of Earth left to discover is that which was the beginning. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Charles, for an extremely exciting talk. And as always, you have time for questions. There's always a lot of good questions. It's great that we get to a microphone.
Since you spoke so much about the political context, you want to be saying how will it finish?
I think the safety issues regarding Hubble are such that it's very unlikely that NASA will mount a mission to Hubble, which is in violation of the rules that the Columbia Accident Investigation Board set down for NASA to follow, and which one side of Congress, at least, is demanding that NASA follow very religiously. I think NASA's put in a very difficult position that it said it would unreservedly follow those recommendations, and doing that to a mission that does not go to space station, where there is no safe haven, where there's no place for the astronauts to wait for a rescue, puts them in a position where they'd have to violate the rules they said they would accept and that Congress is demanding that they accept. So to have another part of Congress say, we didn't mean that rule, is I think putting them in a difficult situation, and I think they want to move on beyond the shuttle and start doing some of the other missions in the sequence, like the Webb telescope and so on. So I think Hubble will continue to operate for another 5 or 6 years in sort of a graceful degradation, if any degradation at all, for the next couple of years, and then we'll move into the next telescopes in the sequence, none of which require risking the lives of the astronauts.
What, if any, connection is there between the programs you described and search for extraterrestrial intelligence?
The question is, what's the relationship between this and the SETI program, search for extraterrestrial intelligence? SETI, in some sense, is misnamed. It's not the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, it's the search for extraterrestrial electrical engineers. You're looking for other radio astronomers or other radio transmitters. And that is a potentially quite specialized branch of intelligent life. And if you don't find it, you don't know what you haven't found. I mean, so a negative answer doesn't tell you a lot. If you find it, it's spectacular. I'm a strong supporter of doing a SETI program because the power of a positive detection is such a monumental thing that we certainly want to engage in such a search. But it's what I would call an ascientific search, not non-scientific. It's highly scientific. But the fact that you don't know what a negative answer means, you can't interpret it. Did you not get intelligent life? Did your intelligent life not last very long? Did intelligent life decide that radio and TV were not interesting? And there are all sorts of possibilities for not having radio communication that would be detectable by SETI. So I think what we're doing is very methodically looking, if you're familiar with the Drake equation, the next couple of terms in the Drake equation, which says how many stars are there, of those stars, what fraction have planets, of those planets, how many are, what fraction is habitable, of those that are habitable, on what fraction does life develop, of those from how many, does intelligent life develop, of those with intelligent life, how many get radio astronomers, and then how long does the whole shebang last? We don't know any of those terms on the right-hand side of that equation. We're going to be able to tell you in 10 to 15 years how many stars have habitable planets, of those, what fraction are habitable, and what fraction might even have primitive life. So it's a very scientific approach to that problem. SETI jumps around all the way to the other end of that equation, and if they get a no, you don't have any knowledge of which one of those terms didn't work out favorably to get more astronomers. So they're linked, but they're just two different ways of trying to get to the same thing.
Question, how does a magnetic field work into the equation? That seems to be pretty important here. And are they detectable, and do you think they are a prerequisite for habitability?
The question is, how do magnetic fields affect the potential habitability of a planet? And I think the answer is certainly on the Earth, as they play an important role in shielding us from the solar wind, for example. And it's clearly important on the Earth. We can certainly sense magnetic fields on the other planets of our solar system. That's always been a part of the probes that we send out. And it's a very interesting aspect of each one of the planets to understand, do they have a magnetic field? Does Mars have one? The Moon, Europa, the different moons, and so on. So certainly within the solar system, we track the magnetic field question very carefully. In the case of Mars, it's of relevance potentially to Mars as a once habitable planet. In terms of the other planets we might find around other stars, we have the techniques quite well developed for studying the magnetic fields in those stars themselves. There's no easy technique to find out about the magnetic fields on any of those other planets. And that remains certainly in the more distant future. It's a very hard thing to detect remotely. Over here, David.
It's my understanding that we now think that stars don't like to form in isolation, complete isolation. They form as part of multiple systems, either with planets or multiple star systems, binaries, ternaries, or perhaps both.
Mm-hmm.
What's the current thinking, maybe based mostly on theoretical grounds, I'm not sure, for the relative probabilities of stars forming as parts of multiple star systems versus stars with planets, and so on?
The question relates to the multiplicity of stars, and by inference, how might planets survive in such a system? And this is really a very active area of research, both observationally and theoretically. If people look at the stability of an orbit of a planet around its star as another companion star, you know, is there, could you form a disk in the first place if you had two stars, you know, in orbiting around one another? If you could form a disk, could you form a planet? Would it be in stable orbits? And it's a very complex and, as I say, ongoing part of theoretical and observational astronomy. One of the things that people talk about, and there's reasonable evidence both theoretically and observationally, is if these two stars are very, very close together, you can get a disk forming around the combination of those two stars. You know, the molecules in the gas in the disk, if the two stars are, you know, practically touching, don't know there's two stars there. So you can get a circumbinary disk and potentially circumbinary planets. Alternatively, let's say you take two stars and separate them by a few thousands of astronomical units, then it's not a problem getting a disk around each star separately. They don't really know about this other star hanging around out there a few thousand AU away, many thousands of year periods. Whether that's stable over the billions of years you'd need to get a stable orbits for planets, stable conditions for life, is really unknown. But so I think there's the idea of circumbinary planets and disks. We've seen some of those. And then we've certainly seen planets around individual members of a distant binary system. As the two stars come in close together, life may just get so confusing that it's quite hard to develop the stability you needed to make a disk, to make planets, and so on. But it's a very active area of research. One right here.
In this search for life, how are we defining life?
The question is, how do we define life in this context? I mean, I think there are certainly biologists, philosophers, and so on, who will take a fairly, who can arrive at very complicated ways to define life. I think as a simple astronomer, I'm operationally looking at it in a fairly simplified way as a potentially a chemical system that can operate out of thermodynamic equilibrium, can take in photons, for example, produce chemical reactions that would not be there if all you had operating was simple thermodynamic chemistry and geochemistry. It's really an operational definition of little chemical factories that do things that normal chemistry does not do on the surface of a planet. Obviously, to affect that on a planetary scale, you get then the concept of replication of that little chemical factory on a planet-wide scale. So the idea of being able to reproduce, exponential growth, comes into that. You have then implicit also the idea that this can be stable over millions or billions of years if we're to be able to see it with any frequency. So I think you can start to derive from the operational definition certain characteristics that this life must have: stability, reproduction, ability to process non-equilibrium chemistry by either bringing in light, producing, taking in certain inputs, say CO2, producing certain outputs, say oxygen, that then we detect through remote sensing.
How would DNA fit into
this definition? DNA in this sense is probably not required operationally. I think the DNA comes in as the one mechanism we know of to help with providing a very stable means of reproducing things, of having life evolve from a more primitive standpoint to a more evolved one. There are a number of different ways, for example, of photosynthesis. Some are quite, and you even have ways of having this chemical factory work even without photosynthesis, but with less energy generating potential. So if you want to have the idea of evolution, of metabolism, the whole idea of having a DNA base that is both stable and capable of evolving in response to a changing environment, you'd need something like DNA itself. Whether it's in fact DNA or not is obviously one of the big questions you'd like to be able to find out by finding...
You could at least postulate different types of DNA-like structures.
Right, like structures. Now, you asked the question, you know, gee, well, what that DNA be made out of? And people, I think when I've talked to biologists about that, you know, is it deoxyribonucleic acid? Maybe yes, maybe no. But is it made out of the same amino acids that we see? They say, yeah. I mean, again, since you look up the carbon, you know, the chain of carbon molecules where you get enough complexity to make proteins and things like DNA, there aren't that many amino acids. So they're probably the same, you know, building blocks that we have on Earth. Would it be actual DNA or some variant? Probably a variant, most likely a variant. But the idea of encoding information through proteins, through the sort of chemistry we see, may well be a feature that is very widespread. That's what would be so exciting, if we could find a different life form, even fossil, on Mars. And that would answer that question. If that turned out to be DNA itself, either there's a strong linkage between the single event that created life on both planets in our solar system, or it's telling us something about the commonality of genetic encoding using chemistry. That's very interesting either way. Okay.
Does the fact that it appears that at one time water was present on Mars, can one infer from that 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 is evidence that someday Earth would look like Mars?
I mean, it depends a lot on what you think the evolution of the sun would be. I mean, that is the furnace from which we all derive our heat. The sun's likely to get more luminous, not less, so it's likely to get warmer here than not. So from that standpoint, we're unlikely to get that cold. On the other hand, there have been very long periods called the snowball Earth, when in fact we did have nearly complete glaciation over the planet. So it'd be a mistake to rule out a very cold Earth. The cold Earth with very little atmosphere is really a function of Mars having such a low surface gravity that it can't maintain its atmospheric density. So it gets the Earth out of the snowball period that it could go into for tens or hundreds of millions of years, is in fact a buildup of CO2 in a dense atmosphere, creates a greenhouse, and that then melts the glaciation. You get back to a warmer Earth. But these are very large-scale cycles that the Earth can go through, and our advantage relative to Mars, which has really been frozen, you know, literally but also figuratively, is because we have a much larger planet that can hold its atmosphere. And it's the dynamism of the relationship between the atmosphere and the surface that makes our evolution quite different from that of Mars.
You mentioned in the introduction that Earth's atmosphere is imprinted with signatures of simple to advanced life. Focusing on the advanced life, what would the key signatures be, and what are the prospects of finding those signatures on other planets?
And the question is, what would be the signatures of advanced life, and might we be able to find those? Well, clearly, you know, CFCs are a signature of some sort of advanced life. Their presence or absence, take your choice. To find the signatures of advanced life, I mean, you want to be looking for our, you know, smog. You want to look for, you know, different relationships of ozone. I mean, there's all sorts of things that if you had much higher spectral capabilities, not just these gross spectra that just show the very big bulk gases, the CO2 that's there in, you know, tens of percent, the oxygen that's there at 10%. You need the ability to see the trace gases. And that requires a lot more light collecting power and a lot better ability to break the light up into its constituent colors at high resolution. Nitrous oxide, various sulfur-bearing compounds, all of those are things that are associated with higher life forms of some form or other. And those are going to be tough to identify with the sort of technology that I've identified. You need telescopes that are a few meters in size. You need telescopes that are tens of meters in size. And if you look at, you know, you can write down what the laws of physics and even of engineering are to produce such a telescope system. Writing down the laws of economics that make such a system fundable, or the laws of engineering to make it launchable, that's a different set of problems. And it's going to be quite a long while before we can do that.
Yes, say you find an interesting object that's within 30 light years, and figuring that in astronomy, telescopes usually go up by a third or fourth power for the aperture and cost. At what point would there be diminishing returns, and at what point would it be worthwhile thinking of actually going there if it's within 30 light years, say a 1,000-year project?
Well, once you get to a 1,000-meter telescope, it might be quicker to try and get there. I mean, it's really hard. I mean, clearly at some point, if you want to image, I mean, we actually had the previous NASA administrator, Mr. Golden, set us the challenge of designing a system that would make an image of the planet itself so you could see the continents, see the oceans. And, you know, you'd like to get, you know, a 25 by 25 pixel image of an Earth 10, 20 light years away. Again, you can write down what the laws of physics would be to make such an image. It turns out you need one Keck 10 meter telescope per pixel on the planet that you want. You have to separate those at visible light by a few tens to hundreds of kilometers and bring the light beams together, do some of this interferometry magic, and you might be able to get an image of such an Earth. At that point, that level of engineering and complexity is such that you might want to think about sending, you know, a little webcam out to that place and beam back the light for your descendants many, you know, hundreds of years, thousands of years in the future might be a better way to bring back the data. Does not have the immediate gratification of getting the image yourself. But in, you know, in the long term, we'd like to break the back of that problem. But it's also, it's doing interstellar travel, we're probably one big breakthrough in physics away from being able to do that. And the reason for keeping all the physicists at this institute funded and well-fed is for them to be coming up with warp drive.
Okay, on that promising note, let's thank Charles again for a wonderful talk.
Great question.